Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 237, we are here with the June 2020 edition of Retinal Physician in a preview episode with Dr. Daniel Chow. We discuss several topics, starting with the recent press release by Genentech Roche about the port delivery system, and then move into scleral buckling, vitrectomy for non-tractional edema, photic retinopathy, and end with the discussion of COVID-19 and home screening for macular degeneration. As always, you can access all the articles discussed for free online at retinalphysician.com. That's RetinalPhysician.com. A list of financial disclosures will be listed in the episode description, and you can claim CME credits for this episode and many other podcast episodes on our website at retinapodcast.com. Just click on the link in the episode description and we'll take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website where you can claim your CME credit. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by Dr. Daniel Chow from the University of California, San Diego. Dan, welcome.
Thank you, Jay, for having me on.
We are here to preview the June 2020 edition of Retinal Physician and talk about some of the right upstairs jumping off points for discussion. In addition, though, Dan, we had some exciting news earlier this week. As complete transparency, this is the first time I've ever had to do this. We recorded this episode a couple days ago, and somehow the file got corrupted. And so Dan was gracious enough to re-record with me and spend another 30 minutes with me talking about the same things. But we're not going to make it artificial at all, Dan. We're still going to keep it natural and keep it real. So, but the one thing we did talk about when we did speak a few days ago, there was this press release earlier this week from Genentech Roche about the port delivery system. It was a phase 3 trial kind of release from the business side of Genentech, saying that it met its 6-month endpoint and there were favorable results for the port delivery system, which we've talked about extensively in the podcast beforehand, and that patients who had the port delivery system were able to maintain out to 6 months equal sort of outcomes to patients who got monthly injections with ranibizumab. So, Dan, your reactions to hearing this and then kind of your reactions to these sort of press releases and how you reacted to them from the industry side versus, you know, when we actually see trial results or podium presentations.
Sure, Jay. So I guess first, just as a disclosure, I serve as a clinical trial investigator for certain of Genentech's trials, not the port delivery system, and have also consulted with them. But first of all, I think this is a great achievement for the whole Genentech team to finally, I think this is our first realization of really convincing data that we have some type of modality that can, you know, get us to, you know, the magic 6 month or longer durability for anti-VEGF, which we, of course, we both realize is really a huge unmet need in ophthalmology. And so to be able to achieve that, I think fairly convincingly, both with the phase 2 ladder and now with this phase 3 study is really a big achievement. You know, one interesting point is that just also, you know, personally, I've been able to meet a lot of the members of the Genentech team that have helped shepherded this, of which there's an amazingly large group of people. But, you know, a lot of them were practicing retina specialists just like ourselves who decided to transition over to the kind of drug and product development standpoint. So, you know, it's very interesting, you know, to see that process and just see how they've done that. You know, people like Ann Fung, Julia Bartoselli, Carlos Quesada Ruiz, and Daniela Ferreira. So just kind of a very interesting role in transition for those other retina specialists that are out there. You know, the other thing that I thought was very interesting, again, kind of more from a historical standpoint, is that probably most of you know that, you know, this product was not originally conceived by Roche Genentech. It was actually developed by a previous a startup called Foresight Vision 4, created also by a well-known retina specialist who's made kind of a lot of innovations, Jean DeWan, who was one of my fellowship preceptors. But when you look at the history of this, I was just looking back on this. So, you know, I think the company probably started 2007 or so, and I'm sure the genesis of the idea was even before that. Then they started collaborating with Roche in 2010. you know, they were acquired by Roche in 2017, and now we're looking at 2020 showing the positive phase three results. So I think just also a good example of, you know, for us retina specialists, that we're in the perfect position to recognize unmet needs, and that if you have an idea, you should go for it, but just also realize the realization of that idea may take, you know, multiple years or decades, but just to persevere through this, and, you know, you can really make a big impact in ophthalmology. And then the final point just about the port delivery system, you know, we've been able to reach, you know, they've been able to reach the 6-month durability mark. But, you know, I think really the biggest thing for me in terms of whether this gets widely adopted is really the long-term safety of this, you know, implant. You know, when we think about, you know, this is a medical device that is, you know, thought to stay permanently for the rest of the patient's life. You know, and this may be 10, 20 years. And so if we start to think about, you know, other comparisons such as, you know, probably glaucoma drainage devices being the best, and, you know, what's really the incidence of conjunctival erosion, endophthalmitis, and, you know, we know from some of these other implants, it's probably between 1% and 5%. And I think, you know, what is that risk-benefit profile for retina specialists in the future?
I think that was really well said. I think it's kind of interesting you said it's only tracing the lineage back any sort of development, to kind of tracing it company to company sometimes to see where it actually came from. And I think the point about the data that's presented here, I think, again, the target audience is not physicians who are looking to make clinical decisions. The target audience is really investors and people interested in investing in a company to give their board of trustees, their investors, more confidence that things are moving forward in a positive direction. So just important to separate that from, again, the podium presentations, which will have much more complete and standardized sort of presentation of data with complications and outcomes and curves and CMT outcomes and the need for reinjection over longer periods of time. But interesting development, something to definitely keep tabs on, and something that we will think about as we go through the next few months. And, you know, I'm already starting to get questions from people from different companies saying, hey, the port delivery system, are you thinking you're going to use it? And, you know, we'll wait and see. It depends on the data. I think if the data is encouraging, we're always looking for better options that can keep these patients and sustain them out over time. But let's transition to this edition of Retinal Physician. The first article we're going to talk about is Tips and Tricks for Scleral Buckles in the 21st Century, subtitled Nuanced Techniques for an Essential Skill. Kyle Kovacs, Anton Orlin, and Paul Hahn wrote this article. You can read the article online at retinalphysician.com, but again, they just go through the different preferences they have for encircling bands and elements you can add, such as tires or segmental sponges. They talk about when you drain. They talk about maybe using a chandelier for visualization, what kind of cases may be better. And they kind of end with a very important point, which is that primary proliferative vitreoretinopathy, for example, subretinal bands in a young patient with chronic RD, isn't necessarily a contraindication to buckling. Those patients can do really, really well. And I think that's a very important point for fellows and young attendings to kind of file away. Just because you see PVR does not mean you have to do a vitrectomy. In fact, I would argue, as they did, that there's many of these patients who will do better with the primary buckle and drain, with or without a drain, rather than just doing a vitrectomy. So, Dan, let's talk about buckling a little bit. You may have kind of, you're a few years out now from fellowship, you may have kind of changed your preferences over time, but what does a buckle look like when you staff a fellow? What band do you use? Do you suture? Do you tunnel? How do you decide when to drain? When do you inject gas? I mean, I think these are the most common questions I get from our fellows when they graduate and they're for doing their first cases, because again, we are doing buckles at many of these our programs, just probably not as many as people were doing 30 years ago in their fellowships.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Jay. And again, just also to emphasize, I think it is a really important skill to learn and be comfortable with when you're doing during your fellowship and beyond. And so my philosophy, I guess, goes really by the saying, like, you know, keep it simple, stupid. So, you know, I think part of that is primarily I would say 100% of the buckles that I do consist of, primarily using a 41 band. And then if pathology ends up being a 41 band encircling band, and if there is pathology that ends up being posterior to the encircling band, then I will use one of these, what I call little sleds, these 103, 106, or 112 elements that you can very easily slide under the buckle, doesn't require too much suturing, and provide some nice support for those posterior pathologies. And at least, you know, for me, I think that that really covers all of the pathology that I've encountered using the buckles. You know, in terms of belt loops and suturing, you know, I think I was exposed, you know, to both, like during residency, it was more belt loops and suture, and I did mostly suturing when I was in fellowship. And I think, again, both techniques are important to learn. You know, now as an attending, I kind of go back and forth, but I think I've settled on doing belt loops primarily, mainly for, you know, efficiency and speed. The other thing I go, but, you know, I think in those instances where, you know, you can obviously perforate with a belt loop or perhaps cheese wire the sclera, then you should be very comfortable going to the suture in those particular quadrants. You know, the other thing that I've kind of gone back and forth is, you know, doing it under the microscope versus without. And I think especially as I'm getting to that presbyopic age, you know, that I may be heavily leaning more to the scope in the future. You know, I like doing it under the scope because you get much better visualization of your partial thickness passes. Unfortunately, because of the narrow field of view, sometimes you have very awkward positioning to throw your suture or your scleral passes. And so I still think it is easier to, if you do it without the scope, either with loops or almost, or with their visualization. You know, the other thing I've really enjoyed using and actually tend to almost use it as a first line option is actually the chandelier to help and use wide field visualization during my buccal cases. Obviously, it's very important to have a good indirect exam. And I think when the break is very obvious, then there's really no need to use a chandelier. But, you know, what I find in many cases, maybe they're pseudophakic with, you know, significant phimosis around the lens capsule, or perhaps the patient is very, very, very sensitive to scleral depression, or you just can't see the break. And I remember a recent case where, you know, clearly there was a detachment. We couldn't actually see the break, even though we had an excellent view. Ended up using, it was an inferior detachment, probably with the highest point around 9 o'clock in the right eye. And I think using a combination of Linkoff's rules, in which we were really looking at that 9 o'clock quadrant, as well as the chandelier, even after, you know, it was a good 5-10 minutes of kind of scleral depressing and trying to find the break. And in the end, it was this very small anterior break, which even with the wide field viewing system was, you know, not easy to visualize. And I think that really helped a lot there. Obviously, we're quite comfortable using it. And so I've really liked having that additional tool, and certainly gives me a lot of comfort if I'm not able to get a great view in the clinic. And just as a last point, I would say definitely in training, I guess what I've tried to do with some of my fellows is that, you know, there's a lot of cases you can go back and forth between vitrectomy, pneumatic buckle, and that, you know, some cases, which may be actually quite straightforward with the vitrectomy, is try to push yourself in. Let's see if we can do it with a buckle, essentially to get more of those reps, get more exposure to buckles, because at least in the region that I'm practicing, you know, there's not a ton of, you know, I would say that the kind of main population would be young myopic phakic patients who have atrophic holes, you know, that the buckle is really clearly the first line option. And so so I think really taking advantages of opportunities as fellows to do buckles and perhaps trying to convince your attending, well, maybe we should try a buckle in this case to get some more of that experience.
Yeah, I think that those are all great, great, great pearls. And I would just add, you talk about sleds. I've heard so many different names for them. I've heard a chip. I've heard cracker. I've heard little nubbin. I've heard so many different things. And it kind of calls back to the days, you know, to think all these elements were made by companies that request the surgeons for these sizes. But back in the day, they would just have a band. They would cut it into whatever pieces they felt were appropriate to match the pathology and slide them in. It was kind of a trial and error using a little artistic creativity. And I think then people started standardizing the production of some of these sizes and these shapes. I think that the The drainage question, I remember as a fellow attending, that was the part they were the most nervous about. I think that's probably the quote unquote least controlled step of doing a buckle. That's where you can get some of the worst complications of buckling. For example, incarceration of the retina, subretinal hemorrhage, or choroidal detachment. But I do think that when done well, it can be very, very elegant. And I think deciding when or when not to drain is a very personal thing. I think that one of the things I try to teach my fellows, though, with buckles, that just to keep in mind, I think you're always kind of scarred by prior experiences. I remember as a fellow, there was a patient that I saw after surgery who had come from, had been referred in for second opinion, who had had a buckle and was a young patient, and post-op day one was no light perception with a total arterial occlusion. And I think that one of the things to remember with buckles is kind of the balance of IOP. There's certain things that increase IOP and there's certain things that decrease IOP when you do a buckle. The things that increase in IOP are tightening a band around the eye and circling band, putting gas in the eye. And the things that decrease in IOP are draining subretinal fluid, doing an AC tap, or giving some sort of medication like a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor like acetazolamide to lower the pressure temporarily. And the whole point is the pressures have to be balanced because the trabecular meshwork has to compensate for the increased pressure. And the eye is going to be at a higher pressure, and different eyes have different abilities to compensate to that. Just like some eyes can fly with a small gas bubble and be fine with the expansion of the gas, and some eyes don't, and they expand and they lose vision. So I always just tell fellows, just be cognizant of the pressure, be cognizant of balancing those things. If you're not going to drain and you're going to pull up a band, you really have to consider how you're going to balance out the IOP appropriately to avoid a issue.
Jay, I think that's a great point, and it's something that we may not necessarily be paying it attention to all the time because we're really focused on making sure the buckle's in the right place and et cetera, whether we should drain or not. But I think that's definitely a key point to emphasize. And then just the question of drainage is that, I think, again, there's multiple ways of doing it. I generally tend not to drain, especially in young patients, especially if it's a shallow detachment. It's a very healthy RPE, and it will pump out that fluid. It may take a little bit longer in a more chronic detachment, but I tend generally not to drain. Of course, there are definitely situations like bullous detachments, et cetera, that likely would benefit from draining. In which case, I generally just use a 27 gauge needle, and I've previously done cut downs and other things like that, but just to actually just go in with maybe to the edge of the bevel just until you start to get some fluid coming out, and then just to express it that way. And I'd be curious what your go-to method is for and to do it in the bed of the buckle.
It's funny, I've adjusted. I was taught to do it in the bed of the buckle so it's supported, but Lisa Almost Dekkoo came on the podcast and gave a presentation at VBS talking about doing it just anterior to the band, kind of sliding it. I find that's actually a lot easier once you've sutured down the band. You don't have to be kind of straining the band over to kind of see where your drainage point is as it's draining. I like to visualize the fluid draining, so I know when it stopped draining, so I know when it's, I usually drain before tightening the band. And I know people do it both ways. But what I'll do is I'll put it just anterior to the band. And I haven't seen any issues with that drain site being a problem, especially with the band pulled up nicely. So, anyway, let's talk about another surgical thing. This other article is vitrectomy and non-tractional macular edema. Is there a rationale by Stefano Rano and Edoardo Ruggiero? They just talk about the idea of doing a vitrectomy for different sort of pathologies with macular edema, especially diabetic macular edema. People have talked about doing this when patients are unresponsive to anti-VEGF and/or steroid injections. They talk about what to do if there is kind of this tractional component with the subfoveal serous detachment and kind of the potential benefits of peeling the internal limiting membrane. Though again, with ILM peeling, I think that with many things ILM peeling, we don't quite understand what's going on there. I think that there's theories about why ILM peeling may help, but it seems to be a lot more complicated than we understand, whether it's we're talking about macular holes or whether we're talking about peeling for diabetic macular edema. Dan, I'll tell you, they kind of conclude that it's sort of debated and we just need more studies, and I think that's probably true. Do you consider this as an option in certain patients? I kind of keep this way in my back pocket for a patient who's completely unresponsive. But I'll just say anecdotally, I've been less than impressed with the visual outcomes. I think anatomically, I've seen great improvements in terms of edema with relief of traction. But I think sometimes, and again, there's the confounder that these diabetic eyes tend to be more fragile, and there's other confounders with going in and doing a surgery at these eyes. What are your thoughts on kind of doing this for eyes with macular edema?
So Jay, I say I would practice very similar to the way that you practice. Generally, use anti-VEGF as first-line treatments. If they're not responsive, then considering a steroid, and then really thinking about vitrectomy as really a third-line option, unless there is clear traction, in which case I think that could easily be, a first or second-line option. I think even a more interesting, or I guess another point just in general is, what should be the role of vitrectomy in managing diabetic macular edema and diabetic retinopathy? I think most of the way that we practice is fairly late in the pathology. But I think one thing that we've talked around before, and I think has been advocated by certain people, is that perhaps early vitrectomy may be a better way to holistically treat diabetic eye disease in general. And, I think when we think about the product profile of what would be a great treatment for diabetic retinopathy, I think number one, I think we all realize it's probably better to treat early rather than late, just because the late complications are very difficult to improve vision. Ideally, it's a single event, and ideally, it lasts for a long time. And we can think of PRP as an example of a very effective therapy as well, especially in non-compliant patients. And I think now there's a little bit of trend to, using more pharmacologic therapy. But I think the idea of doing vitrectomy, quite early, maybe at the initial incidence of PDR or potentially even earlier, I think is an idea that definitely merits further investigation. My personal view is, especially when you start to do, a lot of these diabetic TRDs, a lot of the pathology is potentially due to hyoidal contraction and fibrovascular proliferation. And the way that I see it is that what vitrectomy can do is really get rid of that hyoid scaffold before that fibrovascular tissue is able to grow. And then, of course, you can also put in PRP at the same time. And, I think the only study that we've really, a good study is the diabetic vitrectomy study, which was done many, many years ago. But I think with kind of newer instrumentation, I think most retinal surgeons can, do, it's probably quite straightforward to do a, surgery, not even so much in vitreous hemorrhage, but just, maybe there's some NVE somewhere, and to get rid of the hyoid, put down some endo laser. And, in the same realm, perhaps also with the diabetic macular edema. And so I think that's a really interesting idea to explore. I wish there was a, clinical trial that would test that head to head. Obviously, there might be some issues in terms of risk benefit and how people view a surgical intervention versus these other non-surgical interventions. But I think that's a very interesting idea that I hope we can test in the near future.
Dan, I always love bringing you on or talking to you because you can always blow my mind with kind of this next level thought on a very complicated disease process. I agree completely. And it'll be very interesting to see how that evolution happens. The other thing from a practical perspective with peeling the ILM is that a diabetic ILM doesn't peel as well, quote unquote. It's a little more difficult sometimes to peel the ILM in diabetics. And B, there's some evidence that peeling the ILM in diabetics, for whatever reason, is not good. And by not good, I mean that there are kind of the questions whether it leads to more atrophy or loss of tissue in diabetic eyes versus other eyes. Tom Gardner came on this podcast and he talked about diabetic retinopathy being a neuro disease. It's a neural degeneration, not just a vascular issue. And I bring this up on podcasts a lot because it really stuck with me. And I really wonder, the foot plates of the Müller cells is the ILM is the foot plates of these Müller cells. Is removing the ILM doing something to Müller cell structure and organization? I don't know. But a very interesting thought. But let's tie into our next one, which is a review of photoretinopathy, the dangers of light. This was by Hongwen Hua, Jason Fan, and Nika Bagheri. So basically, they just talk about photoretinopathy, and they really cover solar retinopathy and laser-induced retinopathy, talking the kind of the different mechanisms for why this happens. There's a thermal component. There's also mechanical damage from actually the expansion of fluid causing mechanical damage to the surrounding tissue. And the unfortunate thing about both of these is generally it tends to be centrally, and when it's centrally, then it tends to be more visually impactful. So it's interesting they talk a little bit about treatments and the things people have tried, and there really doesn't seem to be any definitive treatment. People have tried steroids, and the outcomes are super variable and probably related to the degree of energy exposure and the duration. You know, Dan, we've all seen, unfortunately, cases like this. We saw cases after the eclipse, the total eclipse that was a few years ago. That seems like many years ago. It wasn't that long ago. And we've seen cases with laser pointers, and people ask these common questions about handheld lasers for talks or lasers at the supermarket. But the real truth is there's a lot of these lasers available that probably shouldn't be available to people in the public, and they don't realize it's a danger. Any kind of thoughts on laser retinopathy or solar retinopathy?
Yeah, I mean, I think these are very tragic cases a lot of times. I mean, sometimes they actually, you know, they just have a small scotoma and it's not so bad. But, you know, I think especially now with the proliferation of, you know, laser pointers you can easily buy on Amazon, especially in young kids, I guess, primarily males, it's very easy, you know, to, you know, potentially got into the situation where some kids are playing with a laser pointer and end up looking at it in their eye and then have irreversible vision damage. So this is something I'm very anal about with my kids. You know, I have some laser pointers in my backpack for talks and such, and I'm like, don't touch those. And, you know, they've been kind of curious sometimes, but I think it's, you know, I think education is really the key. And I think also, for those that that work with you know, lasers, perhaps in the lab, of course, to have proper safety equipment as well.
Yeah, and I just think that again, it's really one of those frustrating things. Like you said, it can be very devastating to a young patient. A lot of these patients seem to be younger teenagers who've been playing with these pointers. And again, room for improvement. I always think about room for improvement in our field is how can we assist the retina in either recovering or regenerating or some sort of way to recover from these injuries, whether they affect the retina or the RPE. The last article is remote retinal monitoring, the type of COVID-19 by Anat Lowenstein. Decreasing clinical visits keep patients safer in streamlined care, and kind of just goes through the different options for home monitoring. 4C home, for example, the future of possibly home OCT, like nodal vision is developing, and even the idea of doing injections at home. And she talks about how in Israel, that some patients are starting to get injections at home to keep them safe during a pandemic. You know, Dan, I talked about telemedicine a bit this last week with a group, and this we talked a lot about this, but just your impressions, you know, home-based OCT is definitely kind of seems like the holy grail based on our current treatment paradigms. But it does seem like one of the good things from pandemic is you can get some innovation or you can get some acceleration of certain things that maybe people weren't adopting, but now they're starting to use it out of necessity. What are your kind of perspectives on home monitoring for AMD, for example?
Well, I think, Jay, you're absolutely right. So, you know, it's interesting. The idea of home monitoring makes a ton of sense. And we actually have had a tool, but, you know, the 4C Home in their clinical trial showed that this is actually quite effective in getting patients in and, you know, saving vision. But yet, you know, very few of us, it's not widely adopted. And I think there was a couple of reasons for that. Number one, some of it was in, you know, this is my own personal opinion, some of it was just kind of in the implementation of it, is that it just wasn't very seamless for the physician necessarily. And then there were also issues about, you know, reimbursement as well for these kind of telemedicine monitoring, which I think then just doesn't overcome that activation energy and give physicians, you know, sometimes a financial incentive to really implement it. But I think, as you said, I think things like the pandemic, how, you know, even how unfortunate it is, I think there are opportunities that come about. And I think it's really catalyzed this idea is that, you know, we need to be providing more of our care out of the clinic and also to utilize, you know, physician extenders or other ancillary staff to really appropriately take care of all of our patients. And so I think, you know, one thing, I think the home OCT is kind of a very interesting technology, especially if it is really that easy to use and there's a better implementation. I think also the company has done a better job of getting, you know, reimbursement codes as well. And there's been some recent relaxation by CMS of reimbursement for certain telemedicine codes. I think the idea of home injections is a very interesting one. You know, anecdotally, I've heard of some retina specialists who are doing it, and I think it makes a lot of sense in some ways, in that there's a lot of services that are given at home, you know, even things like chemotherapy or home health nurses, which really help to provide, you know, maybe sub-Q injections or other things to help with care. And I think that's something that really needs to be explored for the in the field of retina. I think obviously we have to be very thoughtful of making sure that patients are or staff, if it's not the retina specialist who may be giving these injections, are definitely properly trained, that there's adequate oversight to determine whether there are any complications such as endophthalmitis, and to kind of carefully wait in this area. But I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, because of the pandemic, you know, with social distancing, it necessitates a decrease in the amount of patients that we can actually see in the clinic. So we do have to find additional ways and new paradigms of treatment to deliver care. And just to think about just some options that people are doing even now with their current technology, you know, I think a lot of these hybrid telemedicine kind of paradigms are kind of very interesting and are things that we can implement immediately. And this involves the concept of, you know, patients, you know, they could be coming into the same clinic, yet they're not seeing the physician. They're essentially being seen by a technician for vision, pressure, and imaging, you know, either OCT or wild field fundus photography. Then at some later point, the physician then kind of reviews the images, makes some decisions, perhaps calls the patient back. And so physicians can kind of go through this like almost not quite drive-through, but just kind of very quick express lane and get in and out of the clinic to avoid exposure. And yet, you know, the physician can still, you know, hopefully provide adequate care. I think the one thing that you're missing is obviously the physical exam. And I think one question is, you know, how much are we really missing? And I think that will hopefully be borne out with future studies. But, you know, I think certain people are starting to implement this. You know, some of our colleagues such as Steve Houston, Ihsan Rahimi, and John Miller are really trying to push this concept. And so I think this is a very interesting way to do it, something that we can, that fits already very much into our infrastructure. And so I think it'll be really interesting to see how that's implemented.
Yeah, that was, again, very eloquently said. And we'll see. We'll see what happens. And, you know, home OCT, I think the dream would be some sort of home OCT that doesn't require a separate device, that if it could somehow be incorporated into some sort of attachment, something that could be incorporated into a smartphone, for example. It'd be challenging. It would depend on the capabilities of your camera, and there were probably limitations to it. Probably would be a single scan cut, for example, similar to getting, you know, an EKG, where there's just this, you know, very rudimentary, you know, single lead or three lead EKG. But something like that would be really groundbreaking. Dan, the second time was even better than the first one. I was impressed.
Thank you, Drew. I had some more time, you know, for the second take.
I'm just waiting for that file to crop up in 3 years when I'm wiping my computer when I get a new one. And that will be released with the lost, you know, the lost episodes of the Retina podcast, kind of like, you know, there's always the director's cut, right? The B-side.
Yeah.
Dan, thanks so much for your help, and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. Pleasure as always, Jay.
Take care.
Take care.
As always, you can find this episode and many other podcast episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINApodcast.com. All 237 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You can also find a link to subscribe and get updates in your email box on the latest podcast episodes. There's also our blog, as well as episodes sorted by category. It's great to go look back in the archive and pick out some of the older episodes, especially with the downtime that's occurred during the recent COVID-19 pandemic. I personally subscribe on the Apple Podcast app on my iPhone. You can also find a similar app on your Android device. That's a great way to get updates as the episodes come out. Many thanks to Jennifer Ford and the team at Pentavision for providing these articles in advance. Thanks to Dr. Daniel Chow for joining me for this episode. Thanks to Drs. Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Venancasa for preparing this episode and the accompanying social media. And thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here this every week. This is Jay Schrader, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.